Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for all of those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is, of course, a production of policyforum.net, based right here at the Crawford School, Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school. Have you considered a career in public policy? If you have, you might want to come along and study with us. We've got an amazing range of courses, as well as a wide range of short courses and degree programs that are available to you. You can check out what we have on offer at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Before we get into this week's podcast, we have an important announcement to make. Policy Forum will be hosting its second ever live pod on Tuesday, March the 24th. Our first live pod last year was a really exciting moment, so we can't wait till this next one. Together with ANU Learning Communities and a selected panel of experts, we'll explore how to move forward following Australia's terrible bushfire crisis. We really can't think of a more pressing and important issue to cover, so come along and join us at 5:30 at Cambry Theatre 2 and bring your questions with you. We'll be using our interactive software to collect your questions and your comments, and we'll put them to the panel right on the spot. So, listeners, get out your calendars, make a note, and get your tickets. Just go to crawford.anu.edu.au/news-events, and you can sign up there. It's fair to say this year hasn't started the way the Australian government might have hoped. After being widely criticised for its response to the bushfire crisis, the Coalition is now dealing with the aftermath of flawed policies such as sports rorts or robo-debt. The robo-debt scandal saw recipients of Social Security benefits receiving letters claiming that they had been overpaid, and this was based on a flawed average of their earnings. The government first conceded that there was a problem with its policy in November of last year. While the government made some changes, Government Services Minister Stuart Robert insisted that averaging as the basis to say to a citizen, there may be a debt, please engage with us, was entirely appropriate. However, in February this year, emails from the Australian Tax Office officials to the government revealed that the government was warned about income averaging being unlawful. At the time of recording, the government hadn't revealed when they had received this particular piece of advice. Meanwhile, the Australian Public Service is undergoing a major transition. On December 5th last year, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced a broad suite of changes to the structure of the public service, including merging several departments to reduce their number from 18 to 4. Morrison said that the rationale behind the changes was that Australians should be able to access simple, reliable services designed around their needs, and that having fewer departments will allow us to bust bureaucratic congestion, improve decision-making, and ultimately deliver better services for the Australian people. But a merger such as this is an enormous task, and it brings high costs, as we saw under the Turnbull and Gillard administrations. And public policy researchers have been warning that such machinery of government changes don't necessarily relieve blockages in the system, and sometimes they can create new ones, hampering the productivity of the public service. So today on the pod, we want to have an in-depth discussion around public sector productivity. We want to ask how we can best measure productivity in the public sector and how we might enhance it effectively. To discuss these important questions, we've invited a very special guest to come and join us. Professor Patrick Dunleavy is Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the London School of Economics and Political Science, where he's the Director of the Public Policy Group. He's also Centenary Professor of Governance at the University of Canberra. Patrick, welcome. We're delighted to have you here in the pod cupboard to have a chat with us today.
It's a pleasure.
So, Patrick, in December last year, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced sweeping changes to the Australian public sector or Australian public service, including major departmental mergers. And at the time, he said that this would bring better services on the ground. From your experience, how likely is it that mergers of these kind will have the desired effect?
Well, we did a study of British ministries over a long period of time and found that a lot of the mergers that were taking place in Whitehall had political rationales rather than administrative rationales. And so, you know, sometimes departmental reorganizations can be disruptive of the long-run growth of productivity in services, which actually tends to work best if you have the same organization really focusing on their outputs, looking over a long period of time.
So one of the things that has been much discussed as part of the recent changes in Australia and those changes to the machinery of government has been that the Environmental Policy Department has been moved into the Department of Agriculture. How is this going to impact on how policies are made and perhaps on the outputs or the outcomes of those policies?
Well, I think the Department of the Environment is an interesting department because it was a prisoner of what some people call a new public management approach. So it was very, very orientated to just, you know, we have a list of endangered species and we have a list of legislative objectives. And we just do whatever is required, the absolute minimum of what's required to, preserve this list of species. So, and that approach was pretty bureaucratic, rule-following, narrow approach. So there was a lot of criticism of the Department of the Environment. But moving it into the Department of the Agriculture is just unlikely in Australian conditions to produce better environmental security, I'd have thought. I think it would lead to a lot of conflicts of interest within the department, possibly between different ministers, between different sections. The cultures of agriculture, organizational culture of agriculture and environment are highly unlikely to be consistent. In Britain, where we had a similar merger, because a Labour minister was dobbed in to be the Minister of Agriculture, which was seen as a very adverse posting to get, and they required getting environment to sort of sweeten the pill. And it took the reorganization about 6 years to begin to work because people were on different pay scales and it was very hard to get integrated human management across that department. So I'd have said the auguries are not favorable for that particular thing. And if you think about the current climate change and the difficulties, controversies and the difficulties the government is in, I would have thought it was a singularly maladroit move.
Patrick, I was really interested to hear you mention the problems associated with new public management and what that had meant for the Department of Environment particularly. Can you just give us a kind of a brief overview of where thinking has gone as we've moved away or recognised some of the problems of new public management? You know, what are the principles that are now driving thinking around the best way of managing a public service?
Okay, so new public management really stressed three things. It stressed a kind of a disintegration or fragmentation of government into coherent managerial units called disaggregation. It stressed competition, particularly competition between, you know, in-house and outsourced services. And it stressed incentivization, which is basically don't trust public servants unless they've got a contract, and then you have lots of targets and try and incentivize people with pecuniary means to meet those targets. So essentially those three goals, you know, had some relevance in the late 1980s, but they have degenerated into a terrible recipe for not getting anything very effective done. And I think the themes that we would stress now, what we call digital era governance, First one is reintegration. So basically, you can't tackle things like climate change unless you have a very integrated policy approach. You can't afford to have different bits of government pursuing different objectives. And in the UK, for example, all the agencies that were created have progressively been re-assimilated into departmental groups. Now, Australia has program budgeting, and so it's never really gone as fragmented as it looks, but still, there's a lot of agencies. Every one of them's got a chief executive, a finance director, a director of IT, a director of HR. It's a cumbersome and expensive way of doing things, which Australia can probably still afford because it's had 30 years of economic growth, but most of Europe can't afford it anymore. So reintegration is quite important. Second big theme is holism, treating people in a holistic way, looking across, joining up different services instead of having dozens of different agencies sort of cycle through people's living rooms trying to sort problems. And also integration across services. So, you know, things like, why do we have three different blue light emergency services? Why can't fire people when they turn up in an accident, do the paramedic thing and this kind of stuff? So there's a lot of, you know, holistic scope. And the final big thing is digital change, which has been the absolute motor of major productivity gains in the private sector and has recently, in the last 10 to 15 years, been a big, big factor in the public sector becoming a growing productivity area as well. And on the whole, digital means joining up. It doesn't mean having lots of different managements all fighting over their own targets, their own corporate esprit de corps and all that kind of stuff that new public management stress. So basically, the new themes are reintegration, holism, digital change, very rapid, sustained, well thought through, well grounded throughout the organization, digital change.
And Patrick, you mentioned that particularly when we think about digital change and digital era governance, you know, that it helps us to think about and to think differently about productivity. And of course, for many people, productivity sounds like something that might be more traditionally associated with the private sector. You know, we think about trends in the gig economy and so on. And so our thinking goes in that direction. What does productivity mean for the public sector? How do we apply that concept to the public sector?
Well, essentially, productivity is a very simple metric, and its simplicity sort of repels some civil servants, but it's just basically outputs divided by inputs. Now, in the public service, we know how to count inputs. We've been counting money and staff and lots of other sorts of inputs for a long time. So we've got good metrics for inputs, but people have always been a bit put off by the feeling that they couldn't easily summarize what their outputs were. And there's been a lot of recent intellectual academic advances and practitioner advances, which mean that we can actually measure outputs in the public sector in most areas, not everywhere, but tricky in areas like defense. But let's say you're a social security agency, you've got various kinds of benefits. How do we measure outputs? Well, we look at the number of cases that you're doing under different headings. We multiply by the costs of delivering that case, a unit cost. And then we can aggregate across that to create an overall measure of outputs. Similarly, if you have different taxes, this one's expensive to collect, this one's easy to collect, we can multiply the number of units of taxes collected by the costs, and we get to an overall cost-weighted output. And so if we divide the cost-weighted outputs of an agency by the inputs, and then look over a long period of time, you have to look over 5 to 10 years, what you should see is that the productivity curve is at least flat and hopefully going up. But sometimes what you see is that it's declining, and that's a very serious thing that you need to take urgent action about. Or sometimes you see that it's just not going up over a long period of time. So in our work, we looked at a range of British agencies. Customs and Excise had a stellar productivity growth over 10 years. Social Security managed to not grow productivity over 20 years. So 20 years of continuous productivity slumps and crises and lack of progress because they were very, very slow about implementing digital change. And they're still struggling with that now. We have a whole program in the UK, which was supposed to have been delivered in 2015, called Universal Credit. If we actually manage to get that out the door by 2025, I shall be quite surprised. So,
and what were the particular barriers for that department, for that sector,
right,
that created so much difficulty in achieving greater productivity?
Well, that department, mainly deals with people who are unemployed, people who have ill health, people who've got disabilities, and so on. Back in around 1999, 2000, they decided to have a big shake-up because they had a new Labour government come in. And they decided to move from a paper-based system of administration to a system that would suit their customers. They did consultations with their customers. Everybody said they wanted to do it by phone. They then put in place a kind of 10-year master plan for delivering phone-based services. Didn't work terribly well. After about 5 years, it was in a kind of crisis with a lot of unnecessary phone calls. So at one point they had 300 million phone calls a year. They managed to sort of heroically struggle with this and get it down by 45% within 3 years. Tremendous managerial achievement. But it meant that at the end of the 2000s, the tax agency was doing 85% of their transactions online with people doing self-assessment income tax. Meanwhile, the Social Security Agency, which had been struggling with all this organizational change, was doing half of 1% of their transactions online. So there was a huge gulf between what had happened in tax, what had happened in Social Security. And part of that was that they just didn't experiment. They didn't do anything. They just decided to, go with phone-based services. Now, actually, most online services now are phone-based, but, then they're run in a completely different way. They're using text and screens and so forth, not very expensive people sitting in call centers. And then the other thing that they completely got wrong was that they thought, well, our clientele are poor people. They're never going to be on the internet. In fact, I remember their permanent secretary telling me when I was doing an audit for our audit agency, our people are never going to be on the internet, Patrick. You've just got to accept that. So it's irrelevant to be doing e-services. This was in 2002. And yet, by the end of the decade, 60% of their clients were on the internet with broadband access. So, if you don't have strategic foresight, if you don't really pay attention to the young people in your organization, pay attention to the weird people, the people with, plaits and ponytails and goth hairdos and so on. Often they're the people who have the ideas of where things are going, not the people in suits with the big budget.
Patrick, there is much more that I want to talk to you about, but we're just going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll drill down a bit more into some of the issues that we've been discussing. So for those of you who are listening, stay with us because we will be back to talk about a range of things, including robo-debt in the Australian context.
Hi, I'm Mark Kenny. Each week on the Democracy Sausage Pod, we serve up fresh, meaty analysis of Australia's politics and policy and chew the fat with some of the country's leading experts. It's the podcast for those who like sizzling scrutiny with just a touch of sauce. You can find Democracy Sausage on iTunes, Spotify, or at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back. I'm still here with our special guest today, Patrick Dunleavy. And Patrick, we were talking before the break about some of the experiences in the UK. And I'm wondering what you think is likely to be in store for the public service in the United Kingdom following the most recent election. You mentioned the importance of listening to people who perhaps have a rather different perspective. Does Dominic Cummins wanting to recruit oddballs to come up with innovative policy solutions suggest that the new government doesn't trust the public service, or does it suggest that we're really going to see some genuine innovation as we get different types of ideas coming into play?
Well, it's certainly clear that Dominic Cummings doesn't trust Whitehall. He's been one of the strongest and most outspoken critics. And, he seems to be a very influential player at the moment. So, for example, the recent cabinet reshuffle was more or less bungled because of his insistence on creating a joint team of advisors between the Prime Minister's office and the Treasury, so the Chancellor didn't have any political advisors of his or her own. This will last for, you know, 2 or 3 months before it collapses, because the Treasury has just got such a vast agenda compared to what the Prime Minister is handling. And the Treasury's issues are completely different in character from what the Prime Minister is handling. Also, we've seen an interesting controversy because in this pursuit of weirdos that he announced he was interested in, Cummings recruited a person who was supposed to be one of these super forecasters who was better than everybody else at forecasting things. It turned out that this guy believed in eugenics and various kinds of other unsavory positions in addition to his super forecasting ability, so he had to resign. So that's produced a lot of focus on Cummings. And I think he realized before the general election that when he becomes the story, the thing is malfunctioning. You know, it's already misfiring if he's the story. And yet he's done some strange things like brief the Sunday Times, you know, about how he wanted to more or less disembowel the BBC, including rather frank phrases like, well, we'll have a consultation and then we'll whack 'em, which suggests that the consultation was sort of rather predefined. Anyway, we've had lots of people like this before. We've had ministers like this. Usually the system manages to repel them. Boris Johnson is in an unusually strong position as a premier, so he might be able to sustain this kind of lashing around kind of way of doing policymaking. Cummings has got lots of different things he hates. He doesn't like Britain's aircraft carriers and so on. Well, you know, you can sustain that kind of thing when you're just a policy think tank. But when you're a number 10 advisor and there's just a routine burden of cases and issues and decisions flowing through all the time, that becomes harder and harder. And previous people have tried to do that. So David Cameron had a special advisor who tried to do that. And he soon went off to California and became a kind of measurement guru. So I think that's what I'd predict for Dominic Cummings. On the other hand, the Conservative government is in a strong position. They have probably got a whole year of just doing trade negotiations. There are about 27,000 British civil servants working on aspects of trade negotiations. So that's really another year where very little domestic policy, I think, will be made. But perhaps by the end of the year, you'd begin to see some changes. There hasn't been all that much really that Boris Johnson has ever been associated with. He was quite a middle-of-the-road kind of mayor. He did a few things like brought in some new kinds of buses and a bike-sharing scheme and argued in favor of a bridge of trees across the Thames, a new London airport, the latter two didn't happen. So he tends to be a kind of person who focuses on middle range to small kind of innovations. The big agenda at the moment is bringing the north of England more into the sort of growth perspective that's been true of the south. So it's really hard to say that doesn't look like a radical agenda for change at the moment.
So what are the implications of that for some of the big domestic policy challenges that the UK is facing? You mentioned the Universal Credit Scheme, and we've talked a little about that on the pod before. What are the prospects for those kinds of policies that are so fundamentally important to people's lives in this context that you've described?
Well, I'd say probably not very much happening for the next year because of the trade negotiations. The one exception is immigration, where the UK is bringing in tougher sort of Australian-style immigration rules. But, you know, the real issue is about what the economy is going to do. All the economic consensus is that UK households, on average, are 3,500 worse off as a result of Brexit. Possibly the sort of dynamic entrepreneurial spirits of British industry, which haven't been much in evidence for recent years, might be revitalized by Brexit. Who knows? But the forecast is for very low economic growth, about 1.5%. There's going to be a lot more public spending, partly because whenever you have an austerity period, you have to kind of make up lost ground on services and salaries and so on. So unless there was some real improvement in public sector productivity, it's really hard to see how that's going to map out into more than incremental improvements. But it should be an easier environment for most public servants who are not in the laser beam of Dominic Cummings' pet hate of the week.
Patrick, there's much more we could talk about in relation to the UK in the sort of post-Brexit situation. But I did want to ask you a little bit more about the Australian situation and to turn our attention to robo-debt in particular. And robo-debt was initially meant to increase productivity of government welfare services. Instead, now it's causing some major problems for the government. What do you think has created the problems that have emerged around robo-debt, and how could some of those issues have been avoided?
Well, I think robo-debt is a kind of harbinger of a whole raft of new kind of problems to come, which all stem from what we call BDAI, which is Big Data, Artificial Intelligence. So the accumulation of transactional data by government and the ability to analyze that in more sophisticated ways using artificial intelligence is a huge potential for the public services and a huge potential for improving productivity. So long as it's seen as a long-range, 10-year kind of program. But if you have people who seize on something like this new potential, and think, well, we can have a real political impetus and it will help us in the election, then you tend to get a kind of go-off-at-half-cock type of measure. So, you know, the data matching between the ATO, the tax office, and the Department of Human Services on you know, people's benefit entitlements was actually based on all kinds of very crude stereotyping of people. So, and then a fairly flagrant misuse of government power, actually. So, you know, essentially what happened is that the ATO sent over details of people's income for a year. The Department of Health and Human Services compared it with the records they'd had of what people had claimed under various benefits. And then if the eligibility limit seemed to have been exceeded, they sent out a debt notice, which became active immediately. I mean, and of course then everybody phoned up the Health and Human Services, the phone service collapsed. We've had the Ombudsman's report that was pretty critical. We had the Auditor General saying it was fine, which I must say I was surprised at. And it turns out that 20% of the demands for money were completely groundless. And then most of the other demands for money that were made were excessive. You know, went against the whole Australian tradition of private debt. You know, think that you have a debt to me, I have to establish that legally. But if the government says that you have a debt, that is a debt straight away. So I think the whole issue was based on a misreading of what BDAI, big data, artificial intelligence can do. And you need to realize that people have thousands of different situations, you know, which is very, very difficult to anticipate using just bureaucratic stereotypes. And BDAI is about actually working through. And, for example, supposing somebody was not very well off and they were unemployed and they were claiming benefits. And then in the middle of the financial year, they suddenly get a big endowment, a big inheritance from a relative who's died. So their situation is transformed. There's nothing illegal in them having, you know, that inheritance, but previously not having the inheritance and claiming the money. So that's just one example of why comparing an ATO level and a Department of Health and Human Services level gets you to first base, but it doesn't get you to the level where you're justified in issuing debt demand.
Patrick, as I hear you talking about some of the challenges of using big data in this way and the problematic assumptions that decisions can be made on, I'm thinking back to the point that you made when we started having this discussion, and you said that as we've moved away from new public management, we've thought about different principles, and one of those principles was holism, thinking about the whole person and joined up services. How do we begin to put that principle in place in a way that brings about better productivity and also as part of that brings about positive outcomes for the human beings who are kind of at the pointy end of receiving social services in particular? Because this seems to be something that we've rather lost in both Australia and perhaps the UK, if indeed we ever had it.
The problem is that at the moment the public sector is running lots of different separate information systems. And people have sort of tended to encourage that because they feel that, well, if it's in one filing cabinet but not in another filing cabinet, that will be a protection of individual liberty. And Australian law actually is particularly restrictive. A lot of the original legislation is very restrictive on what purposes you can use data for. But take a problem like, supposing you have somebody, a parent who's ill, maybe mentally ill, maybe physically disabled, but they have children who look after, who are carers, really, are particularly likely to end up later on in life on the social security system themselves. So, you know, once you know that and you can establish that and you can identify those people, you really need to have an active, proactive effort to make sure that they are treated in a very different way so that they then don't end up as future welfare claimants, but they complete their education, they get appropriate role models and confidence building and extra program support designed to offset the very real and, damaging effects of having to, you know, as a child, look after adults. So that's requires a pretty sophisticated level of information. You have to be able to identify those people. It's not rocket science. But we're a long way from doing that in the UK. Australia's a little bit further along, and Health and Human Services are looking at those sorts of issues. And that's really what you can imagine. You know, we should be moving towards a much more personalized kind of welfare and educational and even infrastructure effort, you know, whereas we have very rule-based systems at the moment and of course, we don't stick by the rules, but, we have a lot of workarounds around the rules which help cope with some innovations and difficulties, and then we have a few political distortions as well. So, but rule-based ways of doing things rather than outcomes-based ways of doing things, that's really where BDAI, big data artificial intelligence, can make a big difference.
So, Patrick, I've really enjoyed talking to you about these issues today, but like all very good things, we are going to have to draw this discussion to a close. But before we let you go, I'd like to get one short, sharp piece of advice from you. And of course, ensuring policy effectiveness and public service productivity and good outcomes are all very complex issues. But if you had one key piece of advice that you would like to see policymakers and government officials really pay attention to, what would that piece of advice be?
I think about a 5-year view of your organisation and a 10-year view. Think about a very data-based view because, you know, everybody in organisations has a tremendous capacity for self-deception. You know, there's always something happening that's optimistic or new or challenging. So looking at the basics of what you're doing and particularly how your productivity is growing can be very important. And it just gives you another view. I'm not saying that, you know, a lot of management attention is necessarily bound up with very short-term issues. But, you know, if the public service is not just to become cripplingly expensive, productivity has to grow. And that means, you know, really taking a long view and a database view and being a little bit objective with ourselves rather than being, you know, a lot of public servants I meet tend to be a bit involved in the hype of what they're doing, which is important for morale and leadership and so on. But it's also important to have a realistic, hard look at long-run changes and how in that period you're getting better. And that can make a huge difference to the, you know, strategic ability of the organization and how successful it's viewed by outsiders.
Professor Patrick Dunleavy, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, we really enjoyed today's episode, but we care much more about what you thought of it. And I really hope that you liked our first episode of Ask Policy Forum that we put out earlier this week. We're already planning a second one, so please think about your questions and send them through to us. We're on Twitter as APPS Policy Forum. That's APPS Policy Forum. Shoot us an email at podcast@policyforum.net or get onto our Facebook group, Policy Forum Pod. And another good reason to join the group is that Ask Policy Forum will now be an exclusive podcast for our Pod Squad on Facebook only. So if you don't want to miss out on this very special series where you get to ask all the questions, then definitely hit the join button. We'll leave a link in the show notes. So please reach out to us. It's very easy to be part of what we do. And if you're keen to better understand policy processes, governance institutions, policy analysis, and research to prepare for a policy-facing role, Crawford School's Master of Public Policy might just be the ideal program for you. During your degree, you'll learn from some of the leading academics in their field and get to choose from a wide range of specializations, from social policy through to environmental policy and a whole range of things in between. For more information on the courses that we offer and how to apply, go to crawford.anu.edu/study. And I have one more request before I'll let you go. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you might want to hit subscribe. We're on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you usually get your favourite shows from. And if you're feeling particularly motivated, maybe you'd also like to leave us a review and just find that 5th star. It really would help to get the word out about this podcast and to help us to engage more in the range of policy issues that's facing Australia, the region and the globe. We'll be back next week with another Policy Forum Pod. But until then, from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.